Hello, and welcome along to episode 2 of the Colchester Arts Centre Never Knowingly Understood podcast. My name is Tim Morgan, and this episode is called Saints, Sinners and Sidemen. Coming up in this month's episode, an interview with local hero Rev Simpkins, and the extremely exciting news of a punk supergroup coming to the Colchester Arts Centre on Wednesday the 18th of January. And of course, more picks from Mick, the Art Centre guru. So hold tight and get ready, thrill seekers. First up is a true selection of punk rock music royalty in the form of the Wingmen, comprising of Baz Warne, guitarist and vocalist with the Stranglers for the last 22 years, Paul Gray, one-time bass player with the Damned, Lee Hegarty, guitarist with Ruts DC, and Marty Love, drummer with Johnny Moped. So rather excitedly, I got to catch up with Baz Warne. Did I tell him about the time I missed my train because the Stranglers set overran? You'll have to listen in to find out. But first, I asked Baz how the Wingmen came together.
So can I ask you about with the Wingmen? Now, I've read a little bit about it. I've only heard one of the tracks, Down in the Hole. And yeah. I know you've recently had an album launch as well.
Yeah.
Was it always the intention that there was going to be an album and a tour, or was it a kind of lockdown?
No, there was never going to be. There was no intention to do anything. Mm-hmm. The only intention that we had was to stop ourselves from going mad during lockdown. The whole thing was a complete thing. It was just something to kill the time as far as we were all concerned. I mean, what happened was the drummer Marty and Paul Greer, who plays bass in The Damned, they'd been involved with an album or two, actually, with Captain Sensible. They put like a side project together called The Sensible Grey Cells. They made a couple of albums, and Martin had called Paul and said, listen, I'm going stir crazy here. This is driving me mad. Should we put a band together and do some stuff just for doing some stuff's sake? So, the story goes that Paul said, yes, do you know of anyone that might want to play? They contacted Lee Hegarty, who plays guitar in the Ruts, and asked him, is there anyone that you'd like to work with? For some bizarre reason, Lee Hegarty said me. And I literally got a call later that day. I mean, I've been friends with Lee for a long time. Lee and I have been pals for years because we've done loads with the Ruts. I'd never met Paul. I'd never met Martin. And so I agreed to do it, and we introduced ourselves on Zoom, as we're doing now, and we just started sending stems backwards and forwards to each other. We've got, I've got a studio here at home.
Yeah.
Paul's got quite a good one. Lee records on an iPad, would you believe? All Lee's guitars were recorded on an iPad.
Really?
In his living room. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
The only thing that we couldn't do was the drums, because Martin didn't have the facilities at home to record a live drum kit. So I programmed and Paul programmed home drums, you know, just drum machine, just so that we knew where we were with the tracks and everything. Probably, bizarrely, probably about 2 months, 3 months later, of lots of talking to each other. I remember when we got the first stem sent backwards and forwards, and it was like, do you know, this sounds pretty good. I like this. And it was, I mean, if we'd ever had any intentions of playing it live, we probably wouldn't have put so many tracks and guitars and keyboards and stuff on it, because, you know, you've got to have a limit, I think, where you can replicate it live if you're ever going to do it live. But that was never the intention. The intention was just to make some music with some people who I admired, you know, and we booked a little recording studio that the guys knew in Reigate in Surrey, and we all piled down there one weekend, basically just to get drunk and eat pizza and play guitars and listen to this stuff. And it just became apparent that we all got on very well. Martin had put the drums on last, which is not the way you do things.
Yeah.
Normally the drums, you know, the rhythm section goes on first.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Drums and bass. So, but when you hear it back now, you can't tell. I mean, it just sounds like a band. And then we did that about two or three times, where we would go down and do two or three tracks at a time. and repair stuff to a better studio spec that perhaps we hadn't done so well at home, tidy some vocals up, drop some guitars on. And it became obvious that we were all very interested in this and wanted it to sound as good as it could be. And then before we knew where we were, we had 11, 12 tracks, and it was like, well, that's enough for an album. So we started talking to people who the guys knew. I mean, I've been out of that loop personally for years because of the Stranglers. I mean, I've had such a busy time over the last, well, two decades plus, that kind of thing's never really come into my radar, really. You know, I mean, the lads look after record companies and promotion and t-shirts, merchandise, all that type of thing. I was just, that's somebody else does. I mean, without sounding like a bit of a dickhead, somebody else did that. I just had
Yeah, of
to play the
course.
guitar. You know, it's just that's my job. You know, but I found the whole thing, very interesting and really enjoyable working with the people that I didn't know and hadn't worked with before, and just really to prove that it could be done. And then one Saturday afternoon, we were sitting in a pub, and a guy came who one of the lads had invited from Cadiz Records in Greenwich, London. And he offered us a deal on the spot, and it was like, well, oh, God Almighty, we've got a record deal, you know. But fitting it all in between Stranglers commitments, Damned commitments, Roots commitments, Moped commitments, and now we've got an additional member who is Rob Coombs, who plays keyboards in Supergrass. There's so many keyboards and stuff on the record. We thought, well, we can't replicate a lot of this unless we have a keyboard player. So through a mutual colleague, we got in touch with Rob, sent him some stuff. He loved it. So now there's five of us. We're going out on the road. It's quite hard to believe. We can scarcely believe it, you know.
So in, have you, I mean, have you done much in the way of kind of rehearsals for the tour, or is that something that's going to happen?
That's something that's going to happen. We had a launch in London just the weekend gone there, which was fabulous. We got a little the record company HQ Cadiz is a little cafe in Greenwich, very bohemian, with lights hanging from the ceiling and all kinds of crazy stuff going on. We put it out. There was 70 tickets. They were snapped up, I believe, in a day or half a day or something like
Yeah, I
that.
can imagine.
And so we thought, well, we better play, you know,
Yeah.
considering we'd never played before until last weekend. I mean, the project started in the middle of 2020, and we hadn't played together because we just didn't have the opportunity.
Yeah.
So I went to London on Friday, and we rehearsed for the very first time on Saturday. It was just supposed to be an acoustic set, although, you know, we had a makeshift drum kit. I took an acoustic guitar. The guys, Lee and Paul, both played electric guitars. Rob played a keyboard, and we cobbled together six tracks from the record. And I have to say, it sounded really good. I mean, by the end of the Saturday afternoon, we were all looking at each other, going, "Well, it was a band on paper for a while, and now it's a real band." So when we come to rehearse for the tour, we are going to start the week before and rehearse every day for a week, and then we're
Right.
going to come to you. So you are the guinea pigs.
Yeah,
We're all this is a whole learning curve for everybody, you included.
I don't know if you've played in Colchester before at any venues at all, or
I've never been to, do you know something? I was thinking about this last night. I've never been to Colchester in my life.
right.
I've got
Okay.
obviously I know of it. It's a very old and famous English town. But I've never been there as far as I'm aware. I may have passed through before, but I've never
Yeah.
played there.
Yeah.
Never played there.
Well, hopefully you'll enjoy the venue because it's a
I'm sure I
beautiful old
will.
church and it's got a cracking PA system in there.
Oh,
So,
that sounds great. That sounds great. Fantastic.
it's a great place to come and have a kind of a showcase, I suppose, in terms of starting off how the because you've got 9 days coming up of you the tour. Does it go?
I mean, there was quite a we were quite staggered because there was talk of a tour a while ago, and we didn't really have any dates up until about 6 weeks ago. Which we all thought, I mean, being coming from our respective bands, tours that we do are booked months in advance, I mean, sometimes years in advance. So for it only to, like a lot of months, you know, at least 6-8 months. But for us to be in October and still not have any dates penciled in for January, that was a bit of a worry. And then, you know, and then the agent got on the phone one afternoon after having spread a few, you know, promo CDs and things around, and explained what the whole thing was. And within a day, those gigs just fell into place. And we actually had a lot more offers, but we had to be, you know, sort of more selective. And also, you know, we're not spring chickens anymore. So we did have to arrange for at least a couple of strategically placed days off.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
because they would have had, if they'd had their way, I mean, God love them, if they'd had their way, we would have gone out and done 12 gigs off the spin. And I'm like, listen, I can't do that, you know. I mean, I've got to sing every night. Yeah. If I had to stand there and play guitar, it would be great. But I need to sing and learn all these lyrics for songs that we never thought we'd be doing live. So it's exciting. And I haven't been nervous playing a gig since probably the first time I ever played with the Stranglers, which is 22 years ago now. I've never been nervous, but I won't say I'm nervous, but there's some energy, there's some, you know, some nervous tension energy, we can do it. It's going to be great fun. We just need to make sure that we're as good as everybody thinks we're going to be.
How was the, because you had the album playback as well, how was that received?
It was received very well. I mean, in my experience, having attended a few of these things, people come and there's vol au vents and sausage rolls and lukewarm white wine. You know, they drank the draft beer bar dry before they'd even put the record on. So when it came on, we were up on a balcony area looking down, and you could see quite a few people intently trying to listen, but it was just a load of it. But everyone that came, in the price of their ticket, they got a little goodie bag with a CD in it. So I hope they'll have gone away. And I've had many messages since from people who went away, listened to it in private, and said, wow, what a great record. And in fact, I've been listening to it here at home. I've got a pretty old, trusty sound system with some old BBC Made of Ale monitors, which I'm looking at now, which are brilliant. And it sounds great in the house. So I'm really pleased with it. I mean, considering how it was made, when it was made, it's turned out really well.
And in terms of for the live performance, so on the album, I believe there's 10 tracks. Are there other tracks that you've recorded as well, or is it going to be a mixture of other songs?
Yeah, there's a track that we held back for a bundle, you know, sort of a single bundle with different formats and stuff. We're going to play that as well. So we've got 11 originals, which isn't long enough to headline a set. We've got, the idea was, you know, the guys were bandying around, should we do songs from our parent bands? And it was like, nah, I'm not too keen on that, to be perfectly honest. Certainly not famous ones. You know, I mean, I can state categorically here and now, there won't be Golden Brown if you're coming to hear that. You're not going. So we all picked. I mean, Paul was Paul's been in the Damned twice now. This is his second stint in the Damned. When he was in the Damned in the early 80s, they made two really excellent records, the Strawberries and the Black Album.
The Black Album, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to do a Damned tune from the Black Album that I'm not going to give too much away. We're going to do one of them because Paul wrote it from that era. We're going to do an obscure Stranglers track from 20-odd years ago that I wrote. So, Paul also was in Eddie and the Hot Rods. I don't know if you know that. He was the original bass player in Eddie and the Hot Rods. So
yeah.
We had a couple of ideas for that. So yeah, listen, I'm not gonna. There will be some cover versions, carefully selected, I'd like to say, but they're not really. We just threw a load of them into a pot. It's going to be a varied and interesting set, but in amongst it all will be all the Wingmen album. We'll play everything.
And what about for yourself? I mean, what were your kind of musical, or what are your musical influences?
Oh my goodness. My influences really were just anything that had a really meaty guitar in it. But as I get older, I realize that at some point in the mid to late 1960s, when I was just a baby, my father must have had a car with a radio in it, because I can hear stuff on the radio that I suppose I must have just, for want of a better word, absorbed. I mean, I know that sounds like a bit of a corny thing to say, but I haven't really got any. I mean, I can't really identify with a lot of the music that's around today, because it's not aimed at people like me, and you, when you were younger, you would always, remonstrate with people who went, "Oh, it was the good old days when I was a kid," and da da da, and harking back to stuff that they liked in their youth. Well, I can kind of see that now. The good old. I mean, I love all the great old classics. Beatles, Stones, Who, Kinks, all of that stuff. As I moved into the 70s and grew up a little bit more, my band of choice, dare I say it, was Status Quo.
Nothing wrong with
So
the
I loved the Quo when I was a kid. Oh, I
quote.
did that, honestly. That's the reason why I got into playing a Fender Telecaster, because of Francis Rossi and Rick Parfitt. I don't mind seeing. And then later on, Hugh Cornwell played Telecaster, and I got into stuff that was a bit more raw, although some of the early Quo stuff's really raw. Just, I mean, I find now, I suppose what I'm trying to say is that I find now that I'm sort of a couple of years off 60, I can, without fear of, reprisal, so to speak, I can admit to liking anything. I like a lot. I like an awful lot of music. It's my life, and I suppose you get older and you start taking stock of things. Hey, oh God, I sound like a right old fart, don't I, when I say that? But
No, well, I'm kind of a similar age, so I've got a kind of
oh yeah,
similar view.
how old are you then? Go on, tell me.
Well, I was born 66, so I might be a
Okay.
little
I was
bit.
born in 64, so
Okay. And I think what you say about music, I mean, for me, I think the big music kind of epiphany, I suppose, was when probably about 1979. So I was kind of a little bit too late for the whole kind of early punk thing, although I had an older sister and brother.
yeah.
But it was that kind of discovery of all that great music around 1979,
Yeah.
and John Peel. You know, there was just so much time there, you know, obviously the punk and post-punk and
Yeah.
Two Tone and ska and all of that. It was just, you know, and I do go back to that
Yeah, that was it. I mean,
hugely.
late 70s, 78, 79, in the 80s, 77, 78, 79, it was anything went then, I think. And
No,
like, in
absolutely.
1979, I was 15, so I'll be listening to bands who, well, we'll speak of the Roots, DC, the original Roots. They were a big influence on me. Actually, another big influence on me was the early Pretenders. They had a guitar player called James Honeyman Scott, on the first
Two
two
out,
albums, especially. And what a guitar player he was. And he was only a boy as well, he was only in his mid-20s, really. So yeah, listening back to all that stuff. And then every once in a while, something will come along. I mean, in today's parlance, if you like, I've got a lot of time for Muse, big and bombastic that music is, but it's very inventive, very well thought out, And yeah, I mean, I'll cast my ear across anything, really, I suppose.
And I suppose we can't not mention the Stranglers. I mean, I first of all, obviously, just wanted to pass on all of our condolences because Jet Black
Well.
was just, I mean, I've seen the Stranglers many, many times over the years.
Well, thank you for that. It was, I mean, Jet hadn't been well for many years, to be frank. His health was ailing, physical health, and certainly. But I mean, I made a point of, well, we all did. JJ used to speak to him regularly as well. I would speak to Jet maybe every 6 weeks, couple of months, something like that. And every time I did speak to him, he always sounded chipper, pleased to hear from me. And I'm pleased that I managed to catch him about 3 weeks ago, and we had a right old laugh. He was such a funny, funny guy. But I know his reputation certainly as far as the press and the media were concerned, could be checkered at best. He was certainly a cantankerous old bugger sometimes, and he really wouldn't mind me saying that. And you know, but when you got to know him as I did, he was a hugely warm, affectionate, big teddy bear of a man, and he was lovely, garrulous company whenever you were around him. We always had a great time. And of course, I was fortunate enough to I mean, he retired sort of 2017, I think, was the last time we did something with him. And I mean, by that time, he was nearly 80, you know. So I mean, come on. I mean, people tend to forget that in the Stranglers' heyday, you know, the golden period, if you like, in the late 70s, Jack was in his mid to late 30s then, you know. He was certainly older than everybody else, but he was just a lovely, larger than life character, and to be anywhere near him was great fun. And I used to, me and him just used to laugh. That was above and beyond the abiding thing that I can remember. It was just great fun. And I mean, you know, it was, I mean, when we lost Dave Greenfield, God love him, that was much more of a shock because that was unexpected, totally unexpected. And that really caught us all by surprise. I mean, we, JJ Burnell and myself, we fell off the map for months after that. And then we decided that we'd recorded some stuff in sort of 18, 19 with Dave. And on reflection and listening back to it, there was a lot in there that deserved to be heard. And so because our hands were tied with anything else that we could do, live performance, we decided to try and complete the album, the Stranglers album, which turned into an album called Dark Matters, which was universally acclaimed, actually, and got us the first top five Stranglers album for nearly 40 years, and some fantastic reviews. And all that was done during lockdown as well. You know, and then when lockdown eased the first time around in the October, November time of 2020, I finally managed to get in a car and drive down to the studio in the West Country and start working on it. But you know, losing two pivotal members of a band like that, within a couple of years of each other. I mean, all right, Jet hadn't played for many years. Yeah, it's sad, but you know, especially with Jet, you know, being as old as he was, I refuse to be maudlin about it. I mean, he had a wonderful life. He lived 10 lifetimes, Jed Black, you
Yeah,
know.
absolutely.
If ever there was a rock and roll life to be celebrated, it would be his. So
And was there, I mean, is there a particular gig that kind of that maybe you all played together that kind of stands out?
well, I did a lot of gigs with Jet. I mean, probably 500. Yeah, maybe the one that does stand out is the one and only time up till now that we've done Glastonbury, which I believe was either 2010 or 2011. They had steadfastly refused to put the Stranglers on for many, many years. I mean, it used to be called, it's actually staged, or it was staged in a little village called Pilton, and it was called Pilton Pop for many, many years. And it was kind of CND, and they were sort of really right on and trendy left wing, and you know, and all this type of thing, which is fine. You know, that's fine if that's your thing. The Stranglers refused to do it many times. I think one of them might have got Michael Avis up against the wall by the scruff of his neck, you know, and called him a trendy lefty. I'm not saying who it was. I've got my suspicions. So for those reasons, we were never. And then in as I say, I think it was 11, actually, 2011. We were asked to do it, and it was an unbelievable day. It was an unbelievable day. I'll never forget that day. The weather was I mean, unlike most Glastonbury's, where it hanks down with rain for days on end and everybody gets washed away. The sun was shining. It was absolutely gorgeous, and we were on the other stage, kind of early Friday afternoon. I believe Lady Gaga had occupied the same spot the previous year. She had about 30 odd thousand. There was 80,000 people Came to City Stranglers that day. And we walked out on stage, played for an hour, greatest hits, which, let me tell you, in that kind of atmosphere, under those circumstances, an hour feels like about 8 minutes, you know?
Yes.
We'd literally steamed through it, and I looked down at the set list and thought, ah, we're nearly finished. I'm really enjoying this.
Yeah.
And I looked around at Jet, and he was just beaming smile, you know? He wouldn't let most people see him beam and smile because that was not Jed Black, you know.
No, of course, yeah.
He had to remain stoic, but you catch him at a certain angle. You catch him at a certain angle, beaming red.
Lay his guard down a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. If you knew what to look, if you knew the signs, if you knew what to look for.
Yeah.
And he'd go like, he'd give you a big grin like that, you know. And as soon as it was there, it was gone. So, yeah, I'll always remember that day.
And is there going to be a new album? So obviously Dark Matters was the last album. And I mean, I suppose there was, I suppose going back a few years to, I think it was maybe 2004, 2005, when Norfolk Coast, that was kind of, was that a kind of reformation of the Stranglers sound almost, or it felt like it was?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, that was a new lineup. I mean, I joined the band in 2000. So it's easy to remember how long I've been in the group. And we went out and kept the pot boiling for a couple of years, maybe 2001, 2002. It got to 2003 and we thought, well, you know, we better look at making a record. And frankly, the last album they'd made in 1999 was not great. I mean, no one would mind me saying that. It wasn't a good record. It was very patchy and very poorly received. And so, you know, it was, I mean, I'm not in no, I mean, I've read many times over the years that, you know, when I joined, it was da-da-da-da. I mean, I'm not saying anything about that for 1 minute, but I do know that in any situation, new blood can always be a good thing, whether it's, you know, I don't know, a football team or a management team in an office or whatever. You get someone new in who's got a few fresh ideas and a different perspective. Sometimes it can work, sometimes it can't. Dave Greenfield, JJ Burnell and myself lived together in a house in Somerset for about 8 months. I was still married to my first wife at the time and living up in Sunderland where I'm from. So I flew down from Newcastle Airport. I mean, I knew all of the London crews and the air staff and everything because I did this every week for 8 months.
Okay.
Flew down on a Monday, flew home on a Friday, did that, come back. We lived together and we wrote what amounted to Norfolk Coast. We were still kind of floundering for a direction. Is it going to be hard? I mean, I'm a rock guitarist and I just wanted to play loud, hit the strings as hard as I could.
Mm.
Not really, but you know what I mean. I don't know. And then the song itself, Norfolk Coast, emerged, which is heavy beyond belief. And everybody went, whoa, you know, and that kind of set the template for the rest of the record. And I won't say that we've never looked back since then. That's a bit of a cliche, but I don't think we've looked back since then.
And will there be, so for the 50th anniversary, and obviously that's a kind of closely guarded secret, but I mean, will there potentially be a new album or some retrospectives?
I honestly couldn't tell you. You know, I mean, if I could drop you a little bit of aniseed, I would. But all I know is that hopefully there'll be a date or two to commemorate it. Records take a long time to make these days. I mean, we don't, you know, I mean, the Stranglers have never been, you know, the songs have never really come easy. I know that might sound a bit sort of counterproductive, but it can take a while, you know, to sort through the wheat and the chaff, so to speak. And you never throw anything away. I mean, some of the songs that we did on Dark Matters were leftover songs from years ago. You know, I mean, either the time wasn't right when you wrote it, or there was something didn't click or whatever, you know, but you never throw anything away. There's lots of ideas that we still have. JJ and I have got quite an arsenal of stuff. He's got loads of ideas. It's just, I mean, he lives down in the south of France. So getting together these days is not a case of giving somebody a ring and saying, hey, do you fancy coming round and strumming for an afternoon? We have to arrange it and structure it and stuff, you know, so it's not always easy. I wouldn't rule out another record, but we've got a big mountain to climb if we're going to best the last one, because the last one was the best album in decades, as far as I'm concerned.
Thanks to Baz for being such a fascinating guest. And that thing about meeting your heroes is completely untrue, by the way. What a thoroughly splendid chap. And don't forget to get your tickets for the Wingmen on Wednesday the 18th of January. It is going to be sensational. Whilst I try and compose myself and get ready to be a punk rock teenager once again, let's calm the proceedings down with some of the sage recommendations for January from Art Center guru and legend in residence, Mick, here with Mick's Picks.
Mick's Picks are like a celestial flying teapot ride around a patchouli-scented galaxy, guaranteed to bring wonder and open the doors of perception.
Yes, Mick's Picks for January. Well, we've got 2 week-long events in January. One of them, we've got essential tech maintenance. Not many people are going to come to that, but it will make sure that everything is greased and repaired and ready for the new year. We've also got the January Beer Festival starting on the 24th, running through to the 29th. We've got lots of folky stuff other than that and some good stuff among it. So have a look at the website. It's all up there and it's all available. Have fun. Okay, another mixed pick. This isn't an act as such. In fact, it's definitely not an act. On the 11th of January, which is a Wednesday, we have a wheelchair focus group here at the Arts Centre. And it's all about wheelchair users and their access or lack thereof on busy nights. So if you're interested in coming to that, if you've been to us and you found you've got problems, do come along. You can email beforehand, email anthony@colchesterartscentre.com, and he'll give you a lot more details and tell you what time it's happening.
Next up is an interview with Rev Simpkins. Let me set the scene with the words which I stole directly from his Bandcamp page. Notorious sinner, songwriter, folk symphonist, and Anglican priest, the Rev's unique psychedelic gospel and gritty folk owes as much to the Old Testament and the dark folk tales and barren landscapes of Essex and Suffolk as it does to his musical heroes, Bert Jancks, Captain Beefheart, and the Kinks. He comes from a long line of priests whose fiery performances characterize his own style. Nina sat down with Rev Simpkins to ask him all about his first experiences at the Colchester Arts Centre.
My first experience? Yeah. Oh, it was probably coming to a nightclub when I was probably too young and a sixth former.
Been probably Kaleidoscope or Twisted Lemon or something?
Yeah, no, it was Kaleidoscope. Yeah. So, I have these sort of sixth form memories of really cool bands playing here and not always being able to afford to come, but we would come to Kaleidoscope. And I think my future wife was probably in the building at the same time, but we didn't meet. And then really, I got into the Arts Centre when I came back from college and really started playing here and occasionally reviewing gigs here, and yeah. It is.
What would have been the first time you played here?
Probably with Fuzzface, yeah. Certainly with Fuzzface. And Mr. Chris Secker, who's doing the sound tonight, was just reminiscing about Fuzzface. That was 1852.
Well, the reunion gig was how long ago?
The reunion gig was just before I went off the train to be a vicar. Yeah. So it was June 2012.
Yeah. Because I remember that gig particularly because I stood right at the front and I'm normally pretty sensible with wearing earplugs. Didn't that night and haven't had my ears ringing that much for a very, very long time.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, it's excellent.
Well, no, I need to be careful about this because some members of the band got really bad tinnitus and that is awful.
Yeah.
But when I'm being childish and unguarded, I would just say the wall of sound aspect of it, I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
But kids, be careful, because if you lose your hearing, you can't hear music, and music is the best thing. So,
exactly.
Yeah. But Hammond organs sound great when they're turned right up.
Yeah.
So I used to turn it right up. Yeah. Church organs sound great when they're turned right up. Instruments that move your guts.
Yeah.
Are, I'm sure, scientifically proven to improve your mood. So, that's my excuse for ruining your hearing. I'm very sorry.
Well, and would Fuzzface be your most memorable performance here, or would... Because I was trying to count in my head how many different bands you'd played, and I think I could think of 4 or 5, but there's probably more than that.
I don't want to say some sort of lovey thing, like, oh, they're all very memorable.
You have to pick one.
No, I mean, I really do love playing here, and not just because you've invited me to speak on a podcast. I think one of my favourite ones was when we did an early Sons of Joy gig with me and Dan Merrill. That's two violins, and we didn't play on stage. We just played literally in the middle of the audience, and we just started playing. The beginning and the end of the gig was played in the audience, and then we started playing the very first tune, which was this weird ancient plain chant, but with squalling violins, it captured people's attention. So I've loved all the gigs here, but I really like doing things that capture people's attention in a different way. And working with Dan, it was really joyous in those days.
And what do you think you would say are your kind of most influential artists?
Mm.
I know that's a big question.
Well, it's difficult because I used to lecture in music. I studied kind of classical composition at the same time as listening to the Stooges. So it's hard to say. But just the biggest influences on me or the biggest influences on me that have played at the Art Centre?
Both.
So I'll give you a fulsome answer. My dad was a vicar. I used to play the organ for him growing up. And those old Charles Wesley hymns, which are really soulful and moving and meaningful, still really move me. And they're a touchstone for me. And I love a lot of church music, plain chant, that I think most people these days don't really know, because you think of church music and maybe think of sort of happy, clappy stuff. That's not my scene. And then after that, really, the Stooges, the Fall, the Kinks, various other musicians like Captain Beefheart. But there's only one musician I've got a religious icon of.
Yeah.
And that is John Coltrane, who is he's a saint in the African Baptist Church. And I think his music has really shaped me because of its sort of total commitment and total honesty. And it has real spiritual depth. All the things you probably don't get from listening to my music, but I find it overwhelming. And music for me, in good times and bad, has always been the backdrop. And I mean, I'm a Christian priest. Music is part of that tradition as well.
Yeah, I guess the two things kind of go...
Totally. I just couldn't imagine life without music. And, you know, there's good and bad music in all traditions. But music that tries to sort of reach beyond itself and connect people and has got something to do with community, I think is great. And that's why I love playing here. I know it says the church was deconsecrated, but if you're some sort of wacko priest like me, you would say, once something is blessed, I'd say to you, once something is blessed,
it's blessed forever.
It's blessed.
Yeah.
And I think, don't play this to Anthony Roberts, there's a holiness about the creativity that goes on in that space.
Definitely.
I love the fact that people come together and it builds community. I mean, obviously, there's other things I believe as well. It has a great acoustic. I think churches were built to be good amplifiers. So for a weird priest who likes silly music, there's no better venue in the world, is there?
No, and it's on your doorstep.
It's on my doorstep, and I have this little dream one day that we can use it for Sunday services as well. Because, listeners, if you've never seen the beautiful chancel of the church, the bit behind where people perform, it's full of the most incredible mosaics, and it's a Victorian, that bit of the church is sort of high Victorian Gothic, and I just think it's an incredible building. So if Anthony Roberts becomes a bishop,
well,
he'd invite me to come and lead services here, and I would do so very willingly.
And what about new projects that you've got on the go and coming up?
Wow.
Tell us about those.
Well, thank you for asking.
You're welcome.
I've been ill recently. I'm still having treatment. So I'm still working. But my main coping strategy has been to do as much music as I can. So I went away with Dan Merrill and with Staff Glover to Devon and made a beautiful and strange record that I love. The band is called Lightenings.
Mm.
And the record is called My Days Are Gone Like a Shadow. And that is pipe organs and violins and bass guitars and chants and all sorts of different input. And Dan screaming occasionally and me me singing. I can't really describe it, but I'm so proud of it. And we went to Devon. It was literally the week after I had some bad news about my health, and the other members of the band had had some difficult times as well. So it was this sort of week of music as therapy. Mm-hmm. So hopefully other people will like it, but yeah. The three of us love it.
Well, that's the most important thing, isn't it?
And it's on Lane Cut Vinyl, and it's available to pre-order December. That is with Hyperstatic Union Records, which is Mr. Stafford Glover's record label. And if any bishops are listening, you will recognise that the word hyperstatic is from the Chalcedonian definition of Christology, which was made in 451 AD at Chalcedon. I don't know why staff got this, but it seems very appropriate. And the other thing I've been doing is spending time with a man called Ben Brown.
So Ben's projects are playing here on New Year's Eve, playing with Anna's Bones.
Yes, they've just released a single.
Yeah.
You should download it, and you should definitely come. And you should support the Arts Centre anyway. But anything involving with Ben Brown, I've always loved. And he supported me in February, and we discovered that we're basically in love with each other. So the rest of this year, we've got together regularly, and I'm just finishing off the mixes for an album that I'm very excited about. I'm not quite sure. It's going to be called Piss a Bed Prophet, which isn't rude. It might be called Rev Simpkins Piss a Bed Prophet, but if you know our background, it's full of sort of crazy energy and great melodies and lots of vocal harmonies, because we discovered that our voices together work really well.
Yeah.
So,
and so we just worked. Nickfest here, your debut together?
Yes. So, and we came together and I played bass and he played guitar, and Ben wore my spare cassock and burst through it.
Wow.
I no longer have a spare cassock. Because of his great manliness. I have had it dry cleaned, but it needs to be fixed. Yeah, and we were just sort of, that was in March of this year. So yeah. We were messing around. And then from July, really, we started recording really seriously. And it's been a labour of immense love. And I suspect it's probably the best thing I've ever done. He's done lots of great things. And that will come out next year. So, yes, and that features Ben Ward. He plays drums in Superglue. And Dingus Khan, Toby Ball, of course, he was in First Face with me. My son, Jim, who plays a bit of drums on there. My friend Ed, who is the pianist in the horn section. So it's quite eclectic. Oh, my wife. Don't forget my wife. My wife is the greatest musician on there. So it's like a lot of the recent Rev albums.
A bit of a collaborative effort.
It is a collaborative effort. And Saltings, I'm speaking tonight. Just before playing some songs from Saltings for the audience here. That was very much sort of recorded at the end of lockdown with all family members to hand, whether they wanted to do it or not. But that kind of collaborative working has been really lovely. And if you're not very well and you can't go out and about, it's brilliant to be able to make music at home. And it's kept me sane, but probably had the opposite effect on them. Swings and roundabouts in family life, as you know.
The only thing I was going to ask, Matt, is the calling, so to take up and become a Christian priest.
Mm.
Was that something that was always on the cards, or...?
Well, if you told me in my 20s that I would be a priest, I would have cried with... not in a good way. So I'm the fourth generation of my family to be Anglican priests, and... I grew up in a vicarage in Sudbury, and I've seen what the role actually involves. So forget Vicar of Dibley and various other things on TV. So it's a wonderful role, but it comes at a cost.
Mm.
And there's no hiding from the reality of life in its richness and its joy and its disappointments, I think. So I really, really was not expecting to feel a call to it. And, you know, we'd bought a house, we had a piano, a wife and a child, right? These are the things I always hope that I might, you know. And I was working as a musician, so there was no worldly sense to pursuing it.
Mm.
But as a Christian, I honestly felt that that's what I was being called to do. The best way of explaining it is to say it felt like it was the right thing to do. And it was the right thing to do. But I did give up music once I was ordained, because I didn't think I could fit it in. So when I got cancer for the first time in 2019, because I had everything stopped, it was interesting that I went back to writing, because it was the only way I could cope. And now I realise that I was a mug, that I should have kept going. I mean, I do work 6 days a week, so it's difficult to balance it, but it can be done. And the music I write is not Christian music, I'm not trying to evangelise, but it is about life and death and hope and things. And people seem to really respond to it. And I'm really proud that, you know, people trust me in a secular venue to turn up and make music. It's never an issue with anybody. And, you know, I work with people of all sorts of different faiths.
I think you've definitely managed to kind of get that balance.
Well, I am just who I am.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I'm not trying to treat anybody as a means to an end. Mm. And I know that I'm never going to be a famous musician. So I'm just trying to make the most interesting music and life-affirming music that I can. And I'm also trying to be a passable vicar. You know, Dan, who's my best friend, is a Muslim. Many of my other friends are atheists. I'm happy to give account of what I believe if people want. But if you want to know what I believe, just come and get to know me.
Yeah.
And so it's not, I'm not trying to sort of pull the wool over your eyes and secretly. Who knows, by the end of the gig tonight, maybe the Church of England in Colchester will have doubled. But I strongly suspect it won't. And actually, you know, we started off talking about hymns and things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a Christian history, a mixed and troubled Christian history to this country and to our culture. Well, there's lots of stuff there that is very beautiful and worthy of people's attention. And I know that whenever I sing an old gospel tune or an old plain chant, people are intrigued by it because I think it has an intrinsic beauty.
Mm.
And I just want to share things that I'm passionate about. I feel really blessed that I can do this. It's amazing that I can do music. And really, if I hadn't had music the last 3-4 years, with everything that's happened in the world and in my life, I really don't know how I'd be. But I feel really good because tonight I'm coming out and I'm going to make some music and hopefully people will enjoy it. So there we are.
Sure, thank you so much, Matt.
No, not at all.
Thank you.
And have a lovely gig.
Thanks to Rev Simpkins for that enlightening interview. And I must say, I certainly felt on a higher plane. Thanks for listening in to the Never Knowingly Understood podcast, episode 2, Saints, Sinners and Sidemen. Please like us and subscribe on your own choosing podcast platform or head over to theculchesterartscentre.com and click the podcast link at the top right-hand side of the page.